Welcome to the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the world's most dangerous infomercial. I am your host, Bruce Poinsett. And along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this bi-weekly news, interviews, and commentary experience from the Numbers FM studio in the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every second and fourth Wednesday on the Numbers FM 96.7, as well as catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett and exclusive bonus content by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Right now, we're live on Twitch, so make sure to follow the Numbers on twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, numbers with a Z. But we begin each show with news you might have missed, and this is particularly important because this is going to be our last show before the May 17th primaries. So really tune in. We've got some important stuff today to hopefully get you thinking about the implications of these upcoming elections. But now, without further ado, the news. Our first story comes from the Oregonian, and it is by Peter Sleeth and R. Gregory Noakes, titled "New Historic Plaque Honors Legacy of Formerly Enslaved Couple Who Helped Found Benton County." So according to the authors, a tribute to Reuben Shipley, who was brought across the Oregon Trail as an enslaved man in 1853, but wound up a well-to-do farmer and founding citizen of Benton County, will be unveiled this weekend in Corvallis. The National Society of the Daughters of the American Revolution will raise Shipley's visibility by dedicating a bronze plaque in his honor at his gravesite in the Mount Union Cemetery, 2987 Mount Union Avenue in Benton County near Corvallis at 1 p.m. Saturday. Further in the article, his journey from slavery to freedom occurred at a time when Oregon's fledgling territorial government sought to exclude free Black people. Slavery was ostensibly unlawful, but the law was only loosely enforced, if enforced at all, and a number of Oregon farmers were known to enslave people. Shipley would marry another formerly enslaved person, Mary Jane Holmes, after Mary Jane had been freed by a court ruling. Shipley would later donate 2 acres of land for an interracial cemetery in Benton County at a time when the practice of burying Black and white people alongside one another was rare. Reuben Shipley prospered as a farmer and a local businessman. His children were educated with other local pioneer children. He was known in his community as Uncle Reuben. However, yet enslavement continued to curse Reuben Shipley. 9 years before he arrived in Oregon, 5 members of the Robin and Polly Holmes family were brought to Oregon enslaved from Missouri by their owner, Nathaniel Ford. They lived about 35 miles north of Philamette in Polk County, near the present-day Dallas. One family member, Mary Jane Holmes, would become Shipley's wife. Robin and Polly Holmes, after later securing their own freedom, sued Ford for the freedom of Mary Jane and their children and won. It was Oregon's only slavery trial, Holmes versus Ford, in 1853. However, Ford still refused to give up Mary Jane. So when we talk about this story, it's important because a lot of Oregon's history around Black exclusion laws, which it passed 3 of them, is largely unknown and very, very little discussed. But in that, for the people who talk about that, we often, don't praise, but talk about how Oregon didn't allow slavery. And in reality, even that is complicated, as this story of Shipley, as Reuben Shipley shows, where you had people who brought their slaves from other parts of the country and continued to, force that labor and have people fight for their freedom, even in Oregon. So it's very important we look at, tributes to people like Reuben Shipley, and we look at these stories to continue uncovering this history and continue uncovering just some of the horrors that continued in Oregon despite laws, again, excluding slavery, but also excluding us Black people from living here, period. So our next story comes from OPB by Conrad Wilson. It's titled, "Eugene White Supremacist Who Terrorized College Professor Gets 4 Years in Prison." According to the article, the U.S. Department of Justice, or according to the U.S. Department of Justice, Gary Edward Franklin, 58, targeted a community college professor in part because of her sexual orientation. Around 2010, Franklin took a class taught by a professor identifying court documents as Adult Victim 1. He wore a jacket with a large swastika symbol on the back to an intercultural communications class, federal prosecutors stated in court records. In December 2010, Franklin sent the first of two letters to the community college professor. One included a picture of Diane Whipple's body, a lesbian killed in 2001 by dogs owned by the attorneys for the Aryan Brotherhood, a white supremacy group. Like Whipple, AV1 is also a lesbian. State police later found Franklin's fingerprints on the letter, which also contained the words, "What I'd like to do to you." Under the photo, Franklin wrote, "Don't think for a second that I forgot about you." The second letter, which AV1 did not receive, had a photo of a dismembered woman's body stuffed into a trunk. So, again, when we talk about white supremacy in the state of Oregon, it's not a thing of the past. It is very much very alive. And you have people out here who are very, very bold in trying to intimidate and harm people all throughout the state. And especially outside of the Portland metro area, it's important to take note of this because a lot of people feel emboldened where they think that people aren't, you know, taking notice and people aren't going to organize against their actions. Our next story comes from Willamette Week by Sophie Peel. It's titled, "Mayor's Office May Launch Program to Pay Neighborhood Liaisons to Report Trash, Graffiti, and Camping Hotspots." So according to the article, on Tuesday night, mayoral aide Sam Adams invited leaders of many of Portland's neighborhood associations to discuss homelessness, trash, and graffiti on a Zoom call. Around 40 joined. He shared his plan to create a program whereby neighborhood associations and business districts would each provide one liaison to meet with city officials weekly to discuss homeless camps, trash, and other concerns in their neighborhood. The liaisons would meet with city staffers in clusters determined by current neighborhood coalition boundaries. The neighborhood liaisons, Adams said, would be paid a stipend for their work. Further in the article, the author writes, "This would be the fourth emergency declaration Wheeler has put in place," that's Mayor Ted Wheeler, "has put in place regarding homelessness in the past 2 months. However, if Wheeler does make an emergency declaration, the Portland City Council would still have to approve funding for it in the upcoming budget cycle." Later on in the article, the author writes, "Another notable feature of Adams' plan, neighborhood association's first stop for graffiti removal would be the mayor's office, not the Office of Community and Civic Life, a troubled bureau largely responsible for graffiti cleanup and overseen for the past 4 years by the city's two most progressive and controversial commissioners, first Chloe Udaly and now Joanne Hardesty. Udaly worked to reduce the outsized influence of neighborhood associations at City Hall by weakening neighborhood watch programs and eliminating foot patrols. A common critique of neighborhood associations has been that they offer wealthy homeowners a stronger voice in how the city functions than other groups." So a couple things about this article. First, we talk about paid liaisons to report on trash, graffiti, and homelessness. What I hear, and I feel like a lot of people hear, is so we're paying people to snitch on our houseless community because that's going to help the problem. And that really, it's easy to see which side specifically, as this article talked about, the wealthy homeowners and business associations, that prioritizes. Second part of this article that stuck out to me was moving this work, again, to the mayor's office versus the Office of Community and Civic Life. So in a previous segment, previous show, we talked about how Chloe Udaly was defeated in last city council race by Mingus Maps, who was endorsed by the police union or the Portland, or the PBA, Portland Police Association. And yeah, now to talk about Joanne Hardesty, who is currently being, is currently in a race with, among other people, Rene Gonzalez, who's also endorsed by the Portland Police Union. So put two and two together there. But it is interesting when you watch how the progressive members, or the most progressive members of city council, are being singled out. And their fiercest opponents are representatives, again, Portland Police Union, Portland Business Associations. It's really, we're really looking at just like a polarization and, in my view anyway, again, like a singling out and targeting of progressive votes in these different bodies, with, you know, the houseless community being the ones who ultimately are going to bear the brunt of whatever happens. So stay tuned for more details. If you remember, Sam Adams was also the one who proposed this idea of, you know, armed guards at camps for homeless people earlier. So a lot of interesting proposals coming out of the mayor's office. Final story comes from the Portland Mercury. It's by Alex Zielinski. It actually comes from a partnership between Bolts and the Portland Mercury. It's titled, Portland is the Boogeyman in Washington County's DA Race. And according to Zielinski, in a new campaign video for a Washington County District Attorney, Kevin Barton, a narrator, asks, why does safety matter? Several people then give vague answers about family and community until a woman with a word expression delivers perhaps the most direct response. Quote, because I don't want our county turning into Portland. Although more than 1,000 Portlanders live within Washington County, Oregon's second most populous county, Barton has made the city a boogeyman in his race for a second term in the nonpartisan prosecutor's office. Ahead of the May 17th election, Barton has accused his opponent of wanting to defund law enforcement and framed himself as the only barrier keeping suburban Washington County from descending into Portland-level lawlessness. Fears about Portland, quote-unquote, defunding police have been central to Barton's campaign against his opponent, Brian Decker, a former public defender who also has experience working as a federal prosecutor. In campaign ads, Barton accuses Decker of being an extremist who wants to defund police and abolish prisons. Barton, who declined to be interviewed for the story, points out as justification that Decker helped establish the Washington County Justice Initiative, a nonprofit whose website calls for defunding police, prosecutors, and prisons. Decker says Barton's ads are an inaccurate portrayal of the kind of reforms he actually supports. He says, I have said we need to fund essential police services and we need to reallocate funds to fund addiction treatment, homeless services, mental health care, and other social services, Decker said. Most people in Washington County agree with that, but Barton conflates that with zeroing out the budget of the police because he knows that rhetoric will rally his right-wing base. Further in the article, the author writes, previously a Republican bastion, Washington County has veered to the left since the 1990s with a steady succession of Democrats representing the county at the state legislature. While a district attorney's office is nonpartisan, Barton's politics skew conservative, especially compared to Decker. Further in the article, Zielinski writes, Barton's lobbying work indeed illustrates a certain resistance to reforms. He has discouraged lawmakers from scaling back Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing policy for violent crimes called Measure 11, which charges adolescents as adults, and pushed back against a bill that would require judges to take domestic abuse into consideration during sentencing if it was a contributing factor to a defendant's criminal behavior. Barton also opposed Measure 110, a law that decriminalized small amounts of illegal drugs and funded substance abuse recovery programs. Barton has instead promoted what he calls, quote, responsible reforms, including the creation of a pilot diversion program for criminal defendants with mental health issues and a new resource center for children impacted by domestic abuse. So I will say that this story is a bit personal to me because I am a Washington County resident. And I have, as we get closer to the May 17th primaries, I've seen the Barton ad in question a lot. And I'll be honest with you, it's very disturbing. When I see quote unquote tough on crime ads from district attorneys and other people vying for positions, whether it be sheriffs or other, you know, attorney positions, other lawmaker positions, I know the code for that because we've seen it for years where tough on crime means we are coming for black and brown people to make white voters feel safe. And it hasn't been particularly subtle. And I've also seen these calls and these attacks of this idea of defunding the police, which, again, it's not nearly as extreme as people would like to make it. We defund education all the time. We defund healthcare all the time to our detriment. But the idea that not just should we not look at bloated police budgets, but that we should be scared of the idea, or we should be afraid and silent when everyone suggests to continue increasing them, even though it's showing that it's not having a positive effect on life on the streets. It's not having a positive effect for people. It's wild to me. And when I look at incidents, because people bring this up, especially with mass shootings, you look at something like the subway attack in Brooklyn recently, where you had the police, you had cameras, and it didn't work. It didn't, you know, luckily no one was killed. A lot of people were injured, and it took civilians coming out to even locate the suspect in that. So, and yet still you had politicians say, well, this is an example of why we need more police. It doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't square with the facts. And the fact is, if we're not investing in people, we're not investing in the conditions on the ground, so people are getting more desperate and situations are getting more dire, what do you think is going to happen? You can usually draw a straight line between disinvestment in people and services that are serving people and resources for people and upticks in crime. Not putting more money into the police, not putting more money into people, not putting more money into a system that has done next to nothing to, you know, stamp out a culture of white supremacy within it. And so what's going to happen? Like, if you look at the subways, for example, you look at schools where there's an argument about getting police officers out of schools. When you use school shootings, you use mass shootings, you use attacks, and then you put more officers in these places, they don't get safer. You just have black and brown children or black and brown, you know, public transportation goers getting harassed more. And then you get more calls for, again, defunding, taking these out, with people saying, but what about the attacks? And who bears the brunt? It's us. So I'm very concerned about this push for tough on crime that also, if you're a student of history, always seems to get bigger when you have successful or at least impactful social justice movements, whether it's the civil rights movement of the 60s, whether it's the Black Power movement of the 70s, and more recently, the racial justice protests of 2020 and Black Lives Matter movement that has been growing since 2012, 2013. You're seeing this tough on crime pushback. And you're seeing these white politicians really leaning into the anxiety and just some of the very latent racism of some of their white voters. And we can't fall asleep right now. And that's the news.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick commercial break.
The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer. But will I defend the prequels? Yes. If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett.
Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the B block, where usually we try and keep it a little bit lighter, but since this is our last show before the May 17th primaries, I think it's important to have a little bit of a public service announcement. So yeah, Ado, have you been keeping track of the upcoming elections at all?
A little bit. I've been talking to my family about it because we usually sit down and just kind of like chat about things as it's getting in, but I'm not too deeply well-versed on all of the candidates still getting there, but I would love to hear more about it because I try to regularly vote, especially in local elections, because those ones be moving differently.
Yeah, and that's, again, that's a very important point. And, you know, this idea, a lot of people hear vote local, and it kind of comes off as another cliche, but really it's super important. But, you know, for this case, I just want to make a little more of a general commentary and just put something out there for people, because the closer we get to elections, it's also becomes political apathy season, where the closer we get, the louder you hear some voices, and, you know, voices that in a lot of cases I have a lot of respect for, relationships with, but it's people who are going to tell you, oh, politics doesn't matter. Who cares? It's about this instead of that, or what about this? And those voices get louder and louder, and let's just be real. Mistakes end up happening. You know, very avoidable mistakes end up happening.
Yes.
The news, you know, I've talked about this in the past, but the city council race 2020, where you had someone who, you know, maybe was not the perfect politician, none are, spoiler alert, but you had someone like Chloe Udaly, who was a proven housing advocate, tenants' rights advocate, who somehow got defeated by Mingus Mapps, who was endorsed and well known to be endorsed by the police union.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that that's the most shocking thing. It's Portland, Oregon, after all. But it was the fact that you had a lot of progressive voices, a lot of people who specifically their lane is Black liberation, who somehow got behind Mingus Mapps, where it was like, oh, this is so bad. This is so cartoonishly bad. What are we doing? And you think every election, something like this happens, and you want to tell yourself, oh, that's, people are going to learn their lessons. But then fast forward to spring of 2022, and I'm seeing the same, I'm seeing the same whataboutism. I'm seeing the same, this doesn't matter. Really just general lack of knowledge around what's happening in these primaries. And it's not a general election year, so the midterm elections this fall are not getting, you know, a super amount of attention, never mind the primaries in May. But it's just this apathy that is distressing a little bit. It really is. So I just want to get serious. And I take this very personally, especially as, I'm going to say it as a Black man, because I want to speak, because this is rampant in other circles as well. But I just want to say this as a Black man, because I see, you know, when I split the dichotomies up of, who do I see in terms of political organizing and really leading a lot of these movements, whether it be specifically in electoral politics or just on the ground, active organizing, versus who are the loudest voices, when I see stuff around, again, political apathy, it skews towards Black women and non-binary people who are leading a lot of this work. Like, I say this as someone who works with a lot of Black men in these spaces as well, but these spaces are dominated by Black women and non-binary people out here. There's no way to slice it. And then it's not to say that the flip side is, at least when I'm talking about people who care about the issues but have a little bit of apathy towards politics, it's not to say that it's just they're apolitical. But I often hear things like, look, I want to get involved, but I just don't want to wait on these politicians, or I just don't trust these organizations. And to be fair, I get that, because I'm not going to advocate for just waiting and taking a passive approach to electoral politics. That doesn't work. And I understand a lot of apathy and frustration and disillusionment with the larger nonprofit industrial complex. You have a lot of organizations that are grifting out. No other way to put it.
Very true.
Or they are, you know, they know they get most of their donations from, you know, white people, white-led foundations. So as opposed to doing the work, or as opposed to really prioritizing, you know, improving how they do the work with people in the community, they do stuff where they're spending a lot of time fundraising. And some of those fundraisers can be really gross, where it's like, hey, come here, Black children, and tell your sob story to these rich white people. Mm-hmm. Like, I get it. If you grew up having to do that, especially if you were someone who was on those posters or had to go to, you know, those dinners and share your story just to basically beg white people for money, I'd be disillusioned too. Mm-hmm. I'd be frustrated too. That said, there are a lot of organizations out here doing great work, whether it be, you know, historical organizations like World NAACP, which more recently had a big shift in leadership and has gone far more progressive in these last couple of years when it comes especially to things like the police budget and challenging any increase to it. We've got organizations like Imagine Black out here who are taking it even a step further, where it's not just defunding, but really pushing abolition. You have a lot of people on the ground out here who are trying to do the work, be it, you know, talking about community, like Black Educational Achievement Movement, or BEAM, Coalition of Black Men, who are doing the work with young people specifically. But also, you know, because you're doing this work, it's hard to also get the word out there. It's hard to cut through the noise. And especially during, you know, campaign season, been on social media, you watch TV, you've probably seen ads for these various white men who are just throwing their, I don't need to say their names, you probably know who they are, who've just been throwing their money out there to let you know they exist. But you also notice when it comes to like these trusted community organizations, whether it be Imagine Black, whether it be Apano, be like Latino Network or anyone else, they're not talking to them. They don't have any engagement with them. They just have commercials telling you, hey, I'm a white man with a bunch of money, so I can keep showing you these commercials.
Yes.
Vote for me. And the hope is just to get, you know, it's not, you don't have to get everyone on your side. You just got to get enough numbers in a race with like 7-8 people to get the most votes. That's it. To get through the primaries and get on to the midterms. That's it. It's a small numbers game. But it matters. People tell you these politics don't matter, or, you know, both parties are the same. We got to stop that. We're smarter. Come on. It's an intellectually lazy argument. Both parties, again, are Democrats, Republicans, white-led, white-dominated parties. And that's an issue. But when we just cede our agency, we're not winning.
Right.
These positions, at the bare minimum, we have to, one, differentiate between the marketing and the reality of politics. Politicians may show you these commercials where they market themselves as these saviors to you so they can get your vote. The reality is they control laws. They control the allocation of resources. No matter who's in that seat, Democrat, Republican, nonpartisan seat, whatever. And those resources matter. Those public services matter. But you can't cut the police budget. You can't, even if you want to fully abolish police prisons, you need people inside to make that happen. There's no other way to slice it. And there is power that comes from these seats. And you have people, if you can get people in them, You can make it happen. And your enemies know this. Like, the big thing is funny, during Trump's presidency, he said a lot of, you know, he appealed to a lot of anti-government people and a lot of sentiments, but how were they doing it? How was the administration around him doing it? By infiltrating and dismantling things from the inside while also working the outside. Like, it's not a new concept. It's a very old concept, but oftentimes we, you know, it's that cliche of cutting your nose to spite your face. But we do that with this rhetoric where we basically try and oversimplify it and say, don't get involved, don't get engaged, because it doesn't matter. No, we are at a disadvantage with the power, yes. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, when we organize and vote in our numbers, and more than that, because it's not just voting at the midterms, it's not just voting in the primaries, it's not just voting in the general elections, is getting involved with organizations like some of the ones I mentioned, whether they are politically involved, whether they're more grassroots community, you know, serving organizations, whatever it is, get in there. I guarantee you, wherever you are, there are organizations led by Black people, led by Brown people, doing the work that you believe in the right way. I promise you, they're there. Get involved. Get to know people. Work with people on the ground and do this organizing. And one, you'll find it's a process. Anytime you're working with anyone in a group, there's going to be negotiations. There's going to be disagreements.
Yes.
It's not as fast as you might think. But also, you're going to find that some of the things you're trying to do, some of the things you're trying to advance, the conditions you're trying to change for people, it's a lot easier when you have a group organized. You have different people with different skills and different expertise and experience at your disposal, so you can make things happen. So you're not just an individual trying to fight against fully staffed, fully funded institutions. This whole thing where we're out here trying to martyr ourselves because that's the only thing we can think of, that's dead. It's just, it's not going to work. We know it's not going to work. So to the people out there feeling the apathy, or, you know, they want to get in there, well, does it really matter? It's always been like this. Who cares? Just cut that apathy out.
Cut it out.
Like, just shut that apathy up. I'm sorry. This isn't the time. Oh, we can have these substantive discussions, but every one of these elections, every one of these opportunities to organize and mobilize our collective power, seize on them. And not every lane is yours, and that's okay. That really is okay. But when we convince ourselves to not take advantage of these opportunities, or tell others not to take advantage of these opportunities, trust me, your enemies are. They're seizing power. They're seizing control. It's not, you know, there are not just no consequences when we're not engaged. So again, I look at the apathy out there, and I know people are going to look to whatever, Bruce. You're from Lake Oswego. We don't need to listen to you. But I really hope people prove me wrong. We got primaries coming up May 17th. Get out there, learn about the races, learn about your local DA races, learn about your city council races, your mayor races, your gubernatorial races, your Senate, working Senate, House races. Learn who's out there, who's endorsed by trusted community organizations, who's pushing truly transformative policies. Also learn about the people who have some suspect money behind them. And, you know, maybe question why you see certain faces and you see certain people's commercials so much, but you don't hear about others. Get engaged. Direct electoral politics aren't your thing, but Maybe you care about, you know, working with the kids. There are plenty of organizations, again, doing that work. Get with them. Find them. Learn from them. Learn the lay of the land. And yeah, and this is the B block. We usually have, you know, a joke or something there, and we try and laugh, but how's it scary out here? And my own, I live in Washington County, and our DA's race, the incumbent, is pushing a tough on crime, don't let Washington County become like Portland narrative. And, you know, I'm concerned not just for my own well-being, but youth out here, their well-being. So we can't take this off. We can't fall asleep and then, you know, 2 years later be like, man, this guy's a problem. We can nip that in the bud right now. So I think I'm being hard on people, some apathy, or you think, you know, that's not really the case. Prove me wrong. May 17th primaries are coming. Prove me wrong.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick ad break. BrucePoinsett.com is your one-stop shop for everything Bruce Poinsett. You have my services such as freelance writing and editing, creative nonfiction courses, as well as customized writing classes, event facilitation, and digital content creation. Again, go to BrucePoinsett.com for a quote and make sure to sign up for my newsletter so you don't miss any news or updates. And welcome back to the monthly feature interview. I'm Bruce Poinsett. And again, we do this every month. I have the opportunity to just be in community with a lot of really interesting people doing great work. So I like to share some of those conversations and frankly, just make an excuse to have some of those conversations with them. So this month I have Jennifer Perrine with me, and Jennifer is an award-winning poet, writer, also a writing teacher, and a diversity, equity, inclusion, social justice consultant. We also happen to share a recent honor. Jennifer was awarded one of the Oregon Humanities Community Storytelling Fellowships. So we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, as fellows, talk about projects, the process, and also just life as, you know, full-time freelancers. So, but first off, just Jennifer, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. I am just back from a week away at a writer's conference, which was really energizing and fulfilling. And also now I'm playing catch up. So in that weird limbo spot.
But yeah, I just wanted to, again, congratulate you on the Community Storytelling Fellowship. And just one, you know, I'm curious what made you decide to pursue it?
Yeah, I think when I saw the call that Oregon Humanities put out, this idea immediately popped into mind that I've been in Oregon for about 6 years, and this whole time, you know, part of like what I love about being here is being in the outdoors, a connection to wilderness spaces. And over the last few years, especially, I've been more and more involved with different groups of people of color who are pursuing outdoor recreation opportunities and conservation activism. And when I saw the call from Oregon Humanities, I just thought this community that I'm a part of, there's so many stories here that I just don't feel like I'm seeing in a lot of places. And thought, you know, maybe this is a space to share some of those stories.
Yeah. So yeah, just to pull back a little bit, so I guess it should, you know, frame for people what your project, the focus of your project is, as you said, like people of color and outdoor recreation. And are you specifically doing essays, poetry? I know you're kind of, would you say your medium of choice is poetry? Just on up and up.
Yeah. Historically, my medium of choice has been poetry. The last couple of years, I've been writing more prose. And this storytelling fellowship is my first time doing something that is at least close to journalism, like research essays. Like all of the nonfiction I've written in the past has been personal essays. So this is a big shift for me, and like kind of a challenging one, which I'm also excited about, but is also a little scary.
Yeah, and without, and I know we're still very early in this process in terms of like the fellowship, but so I don't want to make sure I'm spoiling anything, but can you just talk a little bit about, since being here, some of your, like some of the groups you've connected with doing these different outdoor activities and kind of like what that's been like?
Yeah. So for a while I was just kind of, initially I was like hiking and backpacking and I was doing a lot of it on my own or with friends. And I wanted to, you know, meet more people here. And so I started joining meetup groups and had a lot of experiences where the groups were predominantly white and very focused on like, if we're going birding, you will name every bird that's out there and you will have a lot of knowledge about what we're doing. And that was not fun. So I started looking around for other groups and found People of Color Outdoors, which is organized by Pamela Slaughter, and Wild Diversity, and Always Be Burden, which is, it's not a group, but a podcast that's led by Sam Desjardins. And she does this, she leads sort of bird noticing groups for BIPOC groups. And just being in those spaces, it felt much more like we could take our time, sort of explore, ask questions. And it was more about building community and relationships with other folks instead of just, being able to name all the things that we were seeing.
Yeah, I really relate to that idea of just, it's a lot of spaces where they can be white dominated and they become very, for lack of better terms, very academic in like the engagement, where it's just, like you said, it's, you know, we're gonna name all the birds and you gotta be on, you know, on your square on that. But it's like this is a very like communal piece, natural kind of like organic communal piece missing. And especially with just, you know, this kind of really, you know, speaks to me because like in recent years, I've been trying to look more into outdoor, you know, activities and, you know, ways to just get fresh air and get moving, because growing up, I was a basketball player, but as I get older, you know, my ankles, my knees, my back, it's not, just not the same. So it's like, I gotta find something else to do. So I've been starting to like look into, you know, some of these meetup groups and try and find a time to get out there. And then also I see, you know, so what are we going to be doing today? Because people are, you know, I've noticed people are good about, you know, giving you the layout before. It's like, we're going to be hiking 11 miles on this thing. It's like, ooh, well, I need to work up there, but it sounds fun eventually.
Yeah.
But people mix it up though, so it's all right. Even, I remember just thinking about this, I did this project, State of Black Oregon, back in 2015, where myself and Intizar Abioto were driving around the state doing case studies. And as someone who's lived here all my life, you know, that was really the first time I kind of like just took in, even just driving, like whether it be down the gorge or down to Bend or down to Southern Oregon, just like, I really don't, you know, it just hit me just how much I don't, you know, take in some of this nature, you know, spend time in this. And I don't think, I know I'm not the only one. So I really think like projects like this and like telling these stories and highlighting that for people could be just, you know, super valuable for nothing else. But to that point, to kind of get more into the project, you know, again, we talked about being a little early in the project, but I'm just curious, like, as far as like how the process has been going so far and like, you know, do you have kind of like a picture of like what this, you know, the fellowship, for those who don't know, the fellowship kind of amounts to doing, you know, three stories around sort of these topics. And with you, it's like outdoor recreation and people of color, but it's kind of a little free form from there. And they also kind of hook you up with a mentor to help you develop and, you know, expand it. But yeah, can you just talk about where you are in the process so far and, you know, how it's been going?
Yeah. So I'm pretty early in the process, and I just started really interviewing folks for the first piece this week. And part of the reason why I'm just getting started is because I was pretty nervous as somebody who, you know, has a background mostly in poetry, moving into the space of journalism, which maybe shouldn't feel all that different, but I feel like this huge responsibility to care for other people's stories, and was really concerned that I didn't have the skills to do that. So I was grateful to have Caitlin Dwyer as the mentor that Oregon Humanities hooked me up with. And she, we've only met once, but it was so informative, and so it just set my nerves at ease because she was able to give me some structures that I can put into place so that I can make sure that I'm, you know, asking questions and crafting stories in a way that honors other people's stories and isn't, I was afraid that I would come in with an approach and sort of like end up trying to shape things too much to that approach, which is the opposite of what I want to do. I want to follow the story where it takes me, like I would with anything else. And so she was really helpful for that. And so as I've been interviewing folks, I've already heard like amazing stories of all kinds. And now I'm trying to figure out, I have an abundance of folks that I'm interviewing, and how do I shape these all down into, 2,000 words or less, and something that, gives people their due for all of this really great work that they're doing.
So with that said, I did also want to broaden the conversation out to, you know, just your craft in general. And again, you talked about how poetry is your medium of choice. And I like, you had this passage on your website I was just perusing before the interview where you said, my poems have been described as muscular, hardworking, disciplined, grimly witty, scientific, ecstatic, sensuous, mythic, and full of surprises, then in parentheses. I haven't yet decided how many of those terms also accurately describe me. So two questions to that is, one, have you since devolved which ones also mesh with you? But then two, can you just talk about, you know, what got you into writing poetry?
I mean, I think in terms of like all of those descriptors, those things, it's always so strange when somebody like blurbs or reviews your work and you see what they have to say about you. And it's hopefully lovely, but also very strange because, you know, for me at least, sometimes writing comes from this sort of mysterious place, and then somebody else reads it and has this response to it. And I think, oh, wow, it's great that you got that out of it. But maybe I didn't have that in mind initially. And so like when I hear that list of descriptors read back, I think, well, you know, there's a part of me that's super interested in science and super nerdy around sort of all things, especially like biology, chemistry, and and there's a part of me that's super interested in mythology. And so those things might not be about me, but they probably accurately describe what I'm interested in. And in terms of how I got started, I feel like there's always multiple origin stories. I wrote as a kid, like as a little kid, and would make like little books, and they weren't necessarily poetry, but I was always interested in sort of storytelling. But then I think the story that I usually tell is in high school. I had a teacher, I think I was in 10th grade. I had a teacher who assigned us to read the Scarlet Letter. And she, as an assignment in response to the book, she said, you know, you can either write like a report about it, or you can write like a short story or a poem or something along those lines. And I thought, oh, like a poem could be fun. And I talked it through with my teacher, and she said, yeah, you know, maybe here's some different options of ways you could do it. And one of the options was to write a poem from the perspective of one of the characters in the book who didn't maybe get a lot of airtime. And so that's what I did. And there was something about that that just sort of sparked something. And for a long time, maybe even now, I still like to revisit characters in sort of pop culture or like dominant culture that maybe haven't gotten there enough airtime, and see what they might say if they had the space to say it in a poem.
Yeah, yeah. And this made me think of, I do, do videos, and, you just upload it to YouTube, and so oftentimes it's like throwing something into the void. So yeah, on that, especially not just like in a comment, but like having someone actually come up to you directly and be like, that thing you did that touched me in this way, or that affected me in this way, like it's different. I was having a bad night a little while back, and just had one of those instances where I was not expecting it at all, but someone came up to me, was talking about one of the projects I did, and it's just like, oh wow, that just changed my whole demeanor,
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's easy. I know I often have these moments where I'm like, I love writing and I enjoy creating. And there are also moments when I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, what is this good for? And those moments are the things that remind me like, oh yeah, I've made a connection with another person. And that's what it's for.
Well, yeah, Jennifer, that's what I have in terms of questions, but is there anything else you'd like to add, whether it be about the fellowship or just, again, being a writer, trying to, figure it out as we go along in this world?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the only other thing I'd say is that the fellowship is really exciting to me, which maybe I've said before, but I feel like, going back to what we were saying about readings and these opportunities to connect with folks, or even you putting stuff out into the void and hoping that there will be this connection there. I applied for the fellowship thinking I would, that it was a good opportunity for me to help share other folks' stories. And what I've started to find even already at this early stage is it's a good way for me to like deepen my relationships and make new relationships with people who, share my interests and or who whose work I want to support. And so I'm excited to see where that leads over the next however many months before it wraps up.
Awesome. Jennifer, thank you again for taking the time to talk with me today. And I'm really looking forward to reading what you put out with this fellowship. And I will probably be bugging you offline about some of these less taxing outdoor activities so I can... Okay. Get my foot in the door. If there's got some 3 mile, 3-5 mile hikes out here, let me know. But anyways, with that said, yeah, thank you, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Make sure to catch us every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM, as well as on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And for exclusive clips, go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett and become a member. In the meantime, hey, Black people, trust me, it won't hurt. See you next week.